studies in the book of Genesis, and we're about to take a look at the life of Joseph. And yet before we do that, we're going to have one more glimpse at this man, Jacob. Last week we were given a Jacob. And we saw something how by the grace of God, this man who was really a worm, was by the grace of God turned into a prince. And tonight I want us simply to zoom in, as it were, on this particular moment in his life that we read about in this chapter 32, when Jacob stood there terrified at the thought of having to face up to his past. Terrified as he was coming home to meet up with Esau, who you may remember he left 20 years ago. He left him 20 years ago, consoling himself with the thought that if only he could get his hands on Jacob, he would murder him. And Jacob knew that he had to come back and face that. In verse 6 of that chapter, we read that Jacob had sent messengers telling Esau that his brother was coming. And the report that they brought back to Jacob was absolutely ominous. "We went to your brother," it says, "we went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." No word of comfort, no assurance of reconciliation, no olive branch held out to him, no present sent to Jacob. "Only the elder brother is coming to meet you." Marching, silent, menacing with 400 men. And as far as Jacob knew, in his heart was murder. "The elder brother is coming to meet you." And as Jacob understood it, "The elder brother is coming to get you." So the scripture says in verse 7 there, he was in great fear and distress. And you know, Jacob had every reason to be afraid. He was getting what he deserved. He was getting what was coming to him. At least that's what he thought. And he deserved, he deserved everything that he feared. But he certainly was a worm of a man to be despised. Because the more you find out about Jacob, he's not the kind of man that you're naturally drawn to. In fact, he's an absolutely repulsive character. And it's hard, as we were hearing last week, to feel any sympathy for this man. He's the sort of man who you would say just turns you off. I can remember being repulsed by him in Sunday school as a child. And for years that thought has gone through my mind as I've thought about Jacob. I don't like that man. Yet, you know, the more you study his life, and the older you get, the horrifying realization begins to dawn upon you that you really see yourself in that man, Jacob. And yet the other thing that strikes you, as you dig deeper and deeper into the life of Jacob, is the fact that the story of Jacob is the story of God's love. The love that God had to someone who was utterly unlovable. The story of a love that would not let him go. The story of a love that is pure grace and the gracious dealings of God with this worm of a man, this man that we despise. Is seen really as a picture of God's gracious dealings with the nation of Israel. And it presents us with a picture of God's gracious dealings with each one of us. For the incredible thing is that in Scripture God is pleased to be known by his name as the God of Jacob, the God of the despised worm. And as Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians 1, God has chosen the despised things of this world. Why? So that no one may boast before him. Now, I want us to look at this incident and this crisis in Jacob's life, and to do so under three headings. First of all, the background to his fears. Secondly, the encounter that he had. And then thirdly, the blessing that he received. First of all, the background to his fears. Why was he so afraid? Because, you know, this man, worm or no worm, was in fact a man of tremendous natural strength and resources. He always managed, by hook or by crook, and I think it was mostly by crook, to get his own way. Nothing ever seemed to go wrong for him, in a sense. Or in another way, there was nothing that he seemingly couldn't do. He certainly wasn't a great athlete. He didn't have the body of a Sylvester Stallone compared with his brother Esau. But he was so quick-witted that with his brain he could outwit the brawn of his brother. And I think today he's the sort of person that everybody would look up to as a great success. He was a self-made man. He had a talent for self-advancement. He knew how to look after number one. And yet he did it by being utterly unscrupulous. He cheated his own brother out of the precious birthright, and that birthright carried considerable privileges, twice the inheritance, responsibility as the priestly leader in the family. But not only did he cheat his brother, he then cheated and deceived his own father in order to get the parental blessing to ratify the birthright, a sort of seal on his trickery. And he behaved so despicably towards his own family that he had to run away to northwest Mesopotamia, to the plain of Haran, just at the time when his father was on the verge of death and would have needed him. And then he went over to this place in Paddan Aram. He stayed there with his mother's brother, Laban, a mother whom he loved. And no sooner had he got there, but the family genes were at work again. You know, it's fascinating to look into the story of Jacob and to the story of Laban, and to see how the traits that there are in these families are repeated again and again. And Jacob meets up with Laban, and Laban has got the same kind of stuff in him, and the two of them cheat and are cheated, one against the other. And eventually Jacob outwits even Uncle Laban and begins to rob him of all his worldly wealth, until Laban's sons get hopping mad and they come after cousin Jacob. And once again, Jacob is on the run. He was the kind of man who made himself rich at the expense of his nearest and dearest, and he didn't care who suffered. I think for those of you who watched Dallas, JR would have had nothing on Jacob. And I think that in today's world, he's the sort of man that would have had to have come under scrutiny from the Inland Revenue. And yet with his stealth and cunning, he would have covered his traces. Well, you know, we may deceive our nearest and our dearest. We may even deceive ourselves. But we can't deceive God. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. And now you see, Jacob had gotten himself into this awful mess. Face to face with his past. And when you think about it, the root of his problem really was that he tried to engineer God's will for his life. Something that his mother started him on. You remember how Rebekah had been given that promise from the Lord? The elder shall serve the younger. There's coming a day when the elder will serve the younger. Jacob is going to be the one that will receive the birthright. God had told him that. But you see, there came a time in his life and in the life of his mother when they faced the crisis together. Esau had gone out hunting, and Isaac was poised to give the blessing of the birthright to Esau. And it looked as if everything was going wrong. And you can imagine how Jacob would have been arguing in his heart and struggling over this. God had said, I'm going to get the blessing. How would it be possible now for Esau to run off with it? Where would God's promise be if in fact Isaac goes through with his plan to bless Esau? God isn't moving fast enough.
Perhaps God needs me to help him out. So he did. And we've heard the story of how he deceived Isaac, and how the blessing that he'd already stolen from Esau was now ratified officially and sealed. He was again the top dog. He had got the blessing. He had got the birthright. But at what a cost. For 20 years, God was going to have to wrestle with that man because of that. For 20 years, he was going to be a fugitive. For 20 years, he was going to have to sweat it out in the wilderness. For 20 years, he was going to be banished from his family. For 20 years, he was going to have to cheat and be cheated. Yes, he became heir to the promise. Yes, he received the birthright. But there was no joy in that blessing. It was hollow. It was empty. Because he had seized it in his own way. And it wasn't God's way. Are you ever tempted when you have committed something to God to take it back into your own hands and help him out? Because he doesn't seem to be moving fast enough. Because you think perhaps he hasn't got it quite right. That's what his grandfather had done, do you remember? God had promised him a son, and God didn't seem to be moving fast enough. And his wife comes up to him and he says, "Now look here, Abraham, be reasonable. There is no way in which we're going to have a child. God surely has overdone it this time. Just go and take Hagar." You see, it's all right, Abraham, you can do that. I read it in the daily Nuzu tablets from the news agents. It says everybody's doing that. It's the accepted custom. You can do that. That child will be your heir. And Abraham did that. As Oswald Sanders once said to us in Singapore, that's why we pay so much for our petrol. Because Ishmael was born. And that was not the child of the promise. You remember how David one day was in a cave at En-Gedi? Saul was chasing after David. David had been anointed as king. David knew that it was God's will that one day he would rule the kingdom. And Saul comes into that cave, unprotected. And way in the back of the cave, David's men say to him, "David, my goodness, David, this is God's opportunity for you. This is the day God spoke to you when he said, 'I will deliver your enemies into your hand.' Now, David, kill him. He's in your hand. You're going to be king. That's God's will. Here's a chance." And David, knowing his God, says, "God forbid that I should touch the Lord's anointed. That's not God's way." And so he cut off the corner of that robe and let him go. You see, one of the things that happens when you try to help God out in that way, when you try to engineer things, is that you never really know in the end whether it is God's will that you have, because you haven't gone about it in God's way. I may have mentioned this before, but I once had a missionary in my room in Jakarta, somebody that had to be sent home. And the thing that horrified them and alarmed them and terrified them was this, that as they went back home, they said, "I was never sure that it was God's will that I should have been here in the first place." And they went on to say, they said, "You see, when I went before the selection committees of that mission, I pulled the wool over their eyes. I lived in such a way for 3 months. I put on a face, I put on a front. I deceived them.
See, you can never be sure if you don't go about it in God's way. For as we often say, and as Hudson Taylor said so eloquent many years ago, it's God's will done in God's way that secures God's blessing. And because Jacob stole it, because he stole what was God's will, he's standing now afraid and distressed, terrified at what's facing him. Let's look secondly at the encounter that he had in verse 1 of chapter 32. You see, the encounter begins with a meeting with angels. The angels of God met him, it says. Despite all he was, despite all he had done, God was still with him. It was sovereign grace or sin abounding. God followed that man, he pursued him. And so Jacob calls that place Mahanaim, that means two companies. And he was no longer the little company of Jacob, unprotected and exposed. But God was with him, and God graciously gave him that visible evidence. And so he called it Mahanaim, two companies. He was assured that God was with him. It wasn't the first time that God had met with Jacob in a wonderful way. We were hearing last week how he revealed himself to Jacob at Bethel. How he gave to Jacob, right at the time when Jacob was such a rotter, he gave him all the covenant promises that he'd given to Abraham. And he even added a little extra. I will keep you, Jacob, wherever you go, and I will bring you back into this land. The whole promise, the whole blessing presented to him while he was still the wicked and wily Jacob. And you would have thought God was playing with fire. How could he risk giving that promise to Jacob when Jacob was like that? Well, God wasn't playing with fire, because God knew what he was going to do with Jacob. And God's expectations were not in Jacob, they were in himself. And with such promises of divine protection, Jacob should have had peace, but he didn't. He panicked. The interesting thing, of course, is the fact that he was there at Mahanaim anyway was an evidence of the working of the grace of God in his life. You see, if you think about it coldly and logically, the right thing to Jacob to have done when he fell out with his brother Esau, he runs to his uncle Laban in Haran. Now he's moving towards the east. When he fell out with his uncle Laban because there was murder in the heart of Esau back home, the logical thing to have done would have been to have carried on to the east or gone down to the south, perhaps go down to the Ayatollah Khomeini's land in Iran. But God had said, no, come back to the land and I will bless you. And Jacob, to his credit, was seeking to obey God's will. So the fact that he's here at all is an evidence that the grace of God was working and Jacob was responding. And yet you see him being ambivalent about his obedience, in two minds about obeying God. On the one hand, he's obeying, he's come back. But on the other hand, he is struggling to avoid the consequences of what that obedience is going to mean. Because he knows he has to face his past if he obeys. Lord, it's my fault, don't you understand? Yes, if you told me to go there and I didn't know what was coming, fair enough. But you're telling me to go back and face the music. It wasn't you who put murder in the heart of Esau. It was my sin that put it there. And his obedience to the will of God in this case meant that he had to go back and face what had been a terrible failure and an awful situation in his life. God, doesn't that make it all different when it's a result of my failure and my mistake? I wonder if you've learned to trust God, even to overrule the consequences of your own sin and failure and mistake. When he calls you to go to something,
Well, here's Jacob in two minds. On the one hand, he makes provision to obey God, as it were, by the front door, but then he makes sure that the back door is open too, so that he can run away if things go wrong. Alexander McLaren says, here at the beginning of the chapter, you have Mahanai in two companies. The angels of God are with him. And then you find down in verse 7 that he substitutes his own Mahanaim for God. He makes his own company into two companies. And in verse 7, he divides the people into two groups, the flocks and the herds and the camels as well. And here's Jacob, after all the lessons that he's learned, still resorting to trickery, still resorting to scheming. And it's a brilliant scheme, because he thought he knew his opponent. You see, he knew that Esau was the kind of man who saw better than he thought. He was a man of the moment. He was a man who was impetuous. He was a great materialist. He probably didn't care about the privileged position of being priest as the privilege of the firstborn, but he would have cared about the double inheritance he lost. So says Jacob in his own way of arguing, what I'll do is I'll present to him everything that he's lost, flocks and herds, so that he won't be out a penny. It's a wonderful plan. But only one mistake. It wasn't Esau he was having to deal with that night. It was God. In verses 9 to 12, it says, then Jacob prayed. And that's where a positive note comes in. Up until this point, it had all been scheme and cheat as far as Jacob was concerned. And what you now begin to see is a slight change. It's now scheme and pray. The prayer is a very good one in many ways. It starts by claiming the covenant promises of God. And he goes on to recognize that he is not worthy of God's steadfast love. God is getting through to this man. And then he comes to what he feels to be the real point of his prayer. He says, Lord, deliver me from Esau, because he's going to kill me. Lord, deliver me from the hand of my brother Esau, for I fear him. God answers his prayer. And he answers his prayer by coming to him personally, directly, and intimately. And in doing that, he is saying to him, Esau, Jacob, it is not your brother's hand that you have to fear. It's my hand. Jacob, you've got it all wrong. Your problem is not your brother. Your problem is not your past. Your problem is me. I'm the one who's been wrestling with you for 20 years. I'm the one you have to meet this night. It's my face, not his, that you have to see. And as in verse 24, he sends his family across the ford of the Jabbok. He's left alone. And there God, in response to that prayer that's gone up from his heart, meets with him. And there that man wrestles with him till the break of the day. And who was that mysterious man? Where did he come from? How did he wrestle? Was it a physical wrestling match? Was it a mystical wrestling match? How did that man wrestle with him? Who was that man? The Bible says that it was a man. But Jacob also says, I have seen God face to face and my life has been spared. And whatever the outcome, and whatever the nature of that struggling, the outcome for Jacob was both physical and spiritual. And more than that, the scripture doesn't say at this point. And perhaps more than that, we don't need to know, because there is something in that wrestling experience that Jacob went through that night with which each one of us, I think, can identify. Because God wrestles with us in different ways and by different means and through differing and varying experiences. And we don't always exactly know what is happening at the time, and we don't know why he does it this way or that. But all we know, like Jacob, is that after the event has happened, something has happened to us, and we know that God's hand was in it.
Now, I'm no expert in wrestling, despite my sleek build. But I believe that the object of a wrestling match is to get your opponent to yield by bringing him to the point of submission. Leastways, they say that's what's going on when you see those horrific matches on the television.
Now, what was wrong with Jacob for these past 20 years and through his life? The thing was that he was so strong. He acknowledged the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac. If you like, he had theology pouring out of his ears. But he did not submit to that God as Lord. He did not yield to him. And what was God trying to do with Jacob? He was trying to get him to yield, trying to get him to submit. Through that gracious vision that he gave him at Bethel, when he must have overwhelmed him with the grace of the covenant promise and all that he promised to Jacob, he was seeking to get Jacob to bow the knee. Through all the experiences when he struggled with his uncle Laban, and he worked away in the cattle troughs of Haran, all that he was trying to do all the time was to get Jacob to submit. But despite that, Jacob stood still in his own strength. He was still trusting in his own schemes, still trusting in his own abilities. He was still trying to do everything in his own strength. And so now God comes to that man and he wrestles with him with all his might. He wrestles with him in the fears of the night. He wrestles with him through the fears that he has about his future, about his safety. He wrestles with him about the fears he has for his family, for his own life and his conscience. God is wrestling and wrestling with that man, trying to get him to submit, trying to make him yield, trying to get him to the place where he would not move. Yet verse 25 says, even that man could not overpower him. See, Jacob must have possessed, despite the fact that he was not like Esau, I think he must have possessed a tremendous natural strength. And how many of us are like that? How many of us are still trusting to our own abilities, our own skills, devising our own way in life? We're living, in a sense, by our wit or by our intellect. We employ all our talents in such a way, it's as if God doesn't get a look in. He doesn't overpower us. He doesn't prevail against us. And it looks sometimes as if God is defeated in the way that he's dealing with us. Yes, there are times when we give in for a moment and we think we've come to the end of ourselves. But then we bounce back off the canvas. We never give up, we just try harder. But you see, one day, because God will not let you go, because sovereign grace will abound over sin, one day you will have to yield. One day God will have the victory, because God is unstoppable. And God was going to have the victory with Jacob. And he did. He did. And do you see how he got it? He just touched him. That's all. He touched him. And the one who, wrestling with all his strength, man to man, had not been able to get this stubborn man to yield to him, stood back, and with the tip of his finger, he touched Jacob at the point of his greatest natural strength. That was it. And in the very place where Jacob thought he was strong,
He was irreversibly humiliated. Nobody would ever look at Jacob again as a figure of strength. Do you see how God works with merciful restraint? Oh, that is something that as young people we need to understand. God is long-suffering and patient. But that patience of God is to bring us to that place where we want to yield and submit to Him. Don't abuse it. Don't struggle against it, lest He have to touch you. You see, it wasn't that God couldn't overpower him. It wasn't that God wasn't strong enough. That's impossible. You see, it wasn't for lack of might that God didn't crush Jacob. It was the striving of a power that was not concerned with force. It was the striving of a power that was not concerned with an outward victory. It was the striving of a power that was concerned for conquest through surrender, for victory through yielding. And when God wrestles with you and He wrestles with me, He mercifully restrains Himself, seeking to overcome us not by superior force or power, but by our willing submission. I don't think Jacob knew what was going on when he was attacked. I don't think he understood how the touch of God and the finger of God could have done what it did do. But all he knew was that God had touched him, and from that moment on, it hurt. It hurt badly. It hurt for him to do the things that once he did with great strength. Once he strode the length and breadth of the land, looking after the flocks and being the great supervisor of his uncle's flocks. Now he could hardly move. Shattered. No more running. No one would call him strong. Finally, let's just look briefly at the blessing that he received. Someone has pointed out that this battle took two phases. In the first phase, a man strove with Jacob and didn't get the victory. But in the second phase, it's Jacob that takes the initiative in the struggle, and he does get the victory. And here again is a picture of the mighty paradox of grace. It is Jacob who is weakened and wounded and bruised and broken, disabled, who takes the initiative now to strive with God and find the victory. And what was the secret of that striving? Well, it was no longer his strength. No longer his ingenuity, no longer his scheming. You can't think when your hip's wrenched out of its socket. You can't wrestle with a disjointed limb. There's only one thing you can do, and that's cling in weakness because you need help. And that was the secret of his victory, not might, not strength, not ability, not genius, but weakness, helplessness. In fact, it wasn't success anymore for Jacob, but devastating failure. And the wonderful truth behind this that emerges from these passages is that Jacob, as a failure, limping on his thigh, was of more use to God than Jacob, the self-made success story. I wonder if that casts a new light on your life, on some of those failures. Has God taken you through some dramatic crisis of failure? And if you felt that's the end, from now I'm washed up, there's nothing more I can do. This thing humiliates me. Maybe that God had to touch you, because he couldn't really reach you in any other way. Maybe you don't even know what's happened. All you know is that now you try to run and it hurts. Now you try to do the things you used to do, and you find it difficult. You haven't the strength. That confidence you had in your ability is gone. It may have been the touch of God. So Jacob clings to God. Let me go, he says, this man to Jacob. Let me go. The day is breaking. Jacob says, no, no way. I cannot let you go unless you bless me. And he clung to him because he knew it was God. And he clung to him because he knew that without him he couldn't do anything. That was his victory. That was God's victory. That was Jacob's victory. And God wouldn't leave him, and God couldn't leave him. Because it was when Jacob was at his weakest, he was at his strongest. For God's strength was made perfect in his weakness. And the man that God would not let go became the man who would not let God go. That's grace. Jacob pleads now for the blessing. He pleads for the reality of what he's stolen, never found. I will not let you go unless you bless me. He hungered for that blessing. That's why he was so different from Esau. And on the eve of meeting up again with the man from whom he'd stolen the blessing, he pleads with God himself, God, I will not let you go unless you bless me. See what God says to him? What's your name? What's your name? Why did he ask him? He knew his name. Of course he knew his name. But do you remember what happened 20 years ago? 20 years ago when he sought for a blessing? 20 years ago, he heard the same question from the lips of his own father. What's your name? And he pulled the wool over his father's eyes. And he said, my name is Esau. Now as he seeks the blessing again, God comes to him and says, Jacob, I ask you that question again. What is your name? And he says, my name is Jacob. Twister. Cheat. Supplanter. The one who twists you around to get you to do what he wants you to do. The one who twists your arm. God, that's what I am. Jacob the cheat and the liar. Jacob the worm. Bible says God blessed him there. When he saw himself as he really was, no more pretense, no more lies, no more making out, no more confidence in himself. I am Jacob, Lord, and without you I can do nothing. And there God blessed him. And said, your name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men, and have prevailed. For God is committed to those who submit to him, and it is those who submit to him who prevail with God and with men. We sang Matheson's hymn, O love that wilt not let me go. Matheson went on to write, make me a captive, Lord, and then I shall be free. Force me to render up my sword, and I shall conqueror be. I sink in life's alarms when by myself I stand. Imprison me within thine arms, and strong shall be my hand. Let's sing that hymn together, number 552.